Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. This is our feedback show where you are the writers of the content. You, the humans who make this show possible, our irreplaceable patrons. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and we are talking about comments from January on Roald Dahl stories. People had lots to say about AI art and writing and, of course, Cabinet of Curiosities, so let's get right into it.
We're starting with Lamb to the Slaughter. Lewis Davies writes, I think it's probably fair to say that Roald Dahl didn't like adult women very much. His work is full of amazing, twinkly adult men, but women are either hysterics, grotesques, or doormats. Miss Honey from Matilda and the Grandmother and the Witches being the only exception from the children's books. Dahl is simultaneously fascinated, read, super horny for, and repulsed and frustrated with women. With this in mind, I think of this story as a kind of concept-driven horror movie in the vein of, what if that creepy doll was haunted? What if my beautiful, passive 50s housewife was actually a stone-cold calculating killer? This thing that's meant to be cute and enjoyable turns out to be dangerous and frightening. You don't get to hear what the husband's reasoning for leaving her is because it allows Dahl's male reader to insert whatever personal reasons he has fantasized about leaving his wife for into the gap and then experience the full horror of her transformation. Sure, we follow the wife's POV, but it's like the bit in Silence of the Lambs where you are following what Buffalo Bill is up to. That's the comment. That's pretty funny. I agree with a lot in there, although I will say I identified with that. With the housewife. I didn't insert whatever reason I had. It's actually quite the opposite, where I inserted whatever reason I think I should be left for. All right, I knew this was coming. Imposter syndrome extends to relationships too, you know? Someday they're going to find out.
Joshua Weiss writes, whoa. Before reading this comment, I made a very surface reading of Mary as a docile, loving housewife pushed over the edge by her husband's betrayal. Now she feels more like a Emily Grierson from A Rose for Emily, who would rather kill him than let him go. And It's a Ghost writes, here's a link to a great New Yorker article about Roald Dahl. It includes a quote from Ursula K. Le Guin, which I will include below.
This is what it says. In 1972, The Horn Book, a journal of children's literature, published a screed against Dahl by Eleanor Cameron, a children's book author. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, she charged, was one of the most tasteless books ever written for children. The book was not just about candy, it was candy, in that it is delectable and soothing, while we are undergoing the brief sensory pleasure it affords but leaves us poorly nourished with our taste dulled for better fare. Wow. Dahl reviled television, but his book provided the same easy satisfactions. It was a fast-paced, plot-driven celebration of empty calories. The science fiction author Ursula K. Le Guin wrote in to second Cameron's criticism, though she had to admit that children between 8 and 11 seemed to be truly fascinated by Dahl's books. Indeed, one of her own children, she regretted to say, used to finish Charlie and then start right over from the beginning. She was subject to these fits for about 2 months at age 11. She was like one possessed while reading it, and for a while after reading, she was, for a usually amiable child, quite nasty. The books, Le Guin concluded, provide a genuine escape experience, a tiny psychological fugue, very like that provided by comic books.
Oh, wow.
Huh. I have to admit, I mean, I was fascinated by the film that those kids were being basically murdered. It was like a slasher film for kids, and it really surprised me the first time I saw it, and then I wanted to watch it again right away. So there is some instinct for nastiness in kids that gets soothed and satisfied by this content.
Well, and it's comeuppance. You're seeing all these nasty kids getting what's coming to them. Of course, it's extreme. These kids shouldn't die for this, but kids don't care about that stuff.
No.
They just want to see them get it. We also had a few comments about Dahl's anti-Semitism, misogyny, and racist attitudes.
Yeah.
We don't want to ignore that stuff, but we also don't want to be Debbie Downers. We didn't talk about it much when we were doing our coverage of his work.
No, but there's a lot of interesting stuff to check out in the comment section about that. I'll make fun of Roald Dahl for that reason in a few comments from now. Aiden McSweeney writes, I was so hungry for that lamb roast while reading this story. So this story is being, that's a lot more how I process stories, I think. I'm like, that sounds delicious. Matthew Thomas also wrote, I think he rejected her when he discovered that she'd smothered her parents to death with a side of beef. You cracked it. That's actually what the reason was.
That's what it was. And that gets us into the landlady. Mountie of Madness. I hope Mountie of Madness is actually a Canadian Mountie. Probably not, but I'm going to just believe that. Mountie of Madness writes, do stay in a pub guest room. It is fun. When the kids are asleep, you wonder whether you should go downstairs to the bar, and the answer is always, yeah, sure, I'm on vacation. You get to mingle with the regulars, even if you're not super familiar with British pub etiquette and don't know anybody.
Why is Daddy so tired and farting so much?
Yep.
You know, I think Mountie of Madness would just be, she was a Canadian Mountie who read the wrong book, right? And radically yes. changed her mission. Takes on the Wendigo.
Yeah. Joshua Levesque writes, a really enjoyable, tidy tale. But Chad, extra tip of the hat for that excellent Twin Peaks / Boren vibes in the music. I'm Boren.
He's talking about Boren and Der Club of Gore, which is a dark jazz outfit that I was listening to and then ripped off when I did this episode. So good call. Go. I was listening to that stuff when I read the story.
Joshua, I actually had to back up the reading because I was too busy enjoying the background tunes.
Well, you figured out you probably should just go listen to some Boren and Der Club of Gore. Or that's sort of a whole genre of music. There's the Dale Cooper Quintet that also makes that kind of stuff. I do enjoy it quite a bit. It's great reading music. And so, yeah, I was mimicking that a little bit. Oh. But I am going to have more music out this year. I'm going through old episodes of HP Podcraft, actually, and putting together a Volume 3 compilation because there was a lot of that stuff that was never released. And then I'm also doing that to kind of close the lid on it. So I'm motivated to make new music for this show. So that was some of it. Thanks for saying something. It makes me want to do more.
Excellent. Steve writes, Dahl is just a bit too tidy and dull for me. It seemed pretty obvious where he was going from the start. A poor man's Aikman. The Swords had a similar kind of setup, but completely blows this story out of the water. Great reading from, what's her name, though? Wait, who did the reading?
That was your wife.
My wife?
Oh, man. We're going to do this again? Yes! That was her, and it was a great reading. Ed Sizemore writes, I'm thinking that there is only one a year, one victim, because of how long it probably takes to properly preserve and stuff a human. Oh. Richard Horseman responded, good job on remembering to add, quote, probably there. Yeah, Ed seems to know a little too much about that.
A little too much, Ed.
Feedback, episode 7. Let's do a feedback loop. That one was called Malicious Compliance.
Robert Curtin writes, I will buy literally every t-shirt you guys make. Goofy in-jokes are my favorite kind of clothing in spite of my girlfriend's exasperation. I wait in eager anticipation for the Drac Paprika chicken tee.
We're gonna get some new designs up there soon. Yes. It's fun to do. Stacey Kahn writes, listening to you two talk about the evolution, divergence, conflation of the three Billy Goats Gruff made me think about the wealth of horror and weird fiction authors, frequently women, who have used fairy tales as jumping off points for their work. I'm thinking of Naomi Novik, Ursula Vernon, T. Kingfisher, and Kelly Link, all fabulous living authors, but mostly I'm thinking of Angela Carter, who crafted some fantastic reimaginings of Bluebeard, Beauty and the Beast, and Little Red Riding Hood. And unlike the other authors I listed above, Carter is no longer among the living, which would make her stories fair game for you to cover. Am I trying to backdoor pilot an Angela Carter month? August is for Angela? Maybe. But let me sweeten the pot by noting that Carter's short story collection, The Bloody Chamber, I like that title already.
Yeah.
Served as the basis for the Angela Lansbury and Neil Jordan joint The Company of Wolves.
Oh.
So if you want to talk about an inside-out werewolf transformation, there's your excuse.
Oh, there we go.
I do want to talk about that.
Thank you.
I love the key art for The Company of Wolves, man.
Oh,
the werewolf coming out of the mouth. Ugh.
Yes. That movie freaked me out when I first saw it.
Yeah.
God bless it. Jason Thompson writes, I'm so glad someone else is meh on Terry Pratchett.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I could see how you wouldn't like... I mean, you know, I could see both sides of the street on that, actually.
Sure, of course. Ben A. writes, I'd say you two are plenty smart, Chad and Chris. Aw. You can see why I put that comment in.
Yeah, I did.
On a wholly unrelated note, the term Panglossian is regularly used among evolutionary biologists. An important paper written by Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin in 1979 argued against the idea that every trait in an organism evolved for a specific purpose or in response to natural selection. Their point was that many of the traits evolve because they are carried along by other traits with which they share genes, development, or function. Gould, being the literary-minded fella he was, titled the paper The Spandrels of San Marco and the Panglossian Paradigm, referring to the errant idea that everything is made for the best purpose. Evolutionary biologists know this paper well, so that may be the context in which you overheard someone talking about this in the wild.
Well, wow.
Much maybe was. I don't know. I didn't hear the whole thing. I was just wigging out because they said Panglossian. So
I have to admit that when I look at an animal, I assume that every trait of it was evolved through natural selection for some kind of survival. I do have that Panglossian view.
Sure.
And this comment's very illuminating to me. Maybe the cat has this patchy coat, and you think, oh, so it must have evolved in some sun-dappled prairie land or whatever. And it just happens that no, the trait is that it's more vocal, and that's a piggyback on that. It means nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fascinating, and I just learned something.
So cool.
Steve writes, I think Gilgamesh was probably the first sword and sorcery. It's as old as stories can be. Fiction comes from sword and sorcery. It's not the other way around. Suck it, literature. Steve, you're right.
I don't know anything about Gilgamesh.
Gilgamesh is pretty rad. I don't know why we haven't covered it. It's like the original weird story, too, because it's got goofy stuff going on in there, as any myth would. Into the Sound Machine. Hayden Orr writes, love these episodes where Chad ends up playing a cheeky devil's advocate for something that's probably objectively ridiculous or unprovable, but still kind of makes a good point. Chris will come in with a rational and clear statement based on a general understanding of science and reason, and then Chad comes back with, yeah, the crust is made of rock, but how do we know the inside of the moon isn't made of cheese, huh? Can't prove it, therefore moonchi. Great episode, fellas. You know, I think he just wrote like the AI formula for our show.
Oh, dang.
Make 80s reference. Talk about everything changing. Cleansing bolt of lightning.
Oh, boy, that would take a load of work off my shoulders. I'd appreciate that.
Oh, man.
Fred Benarski writes, curiously, as I have learned just a couple of hours after listening to the episode, because it was randomly mentioned on QI, plants actually emit ultrasonic screams when in pain.
Whoa.
A bit more info here, and there's a link. Between learning about this and the mycorrhizal networks and cordyceps, I can't help but agree with Chad. Plants and fungi are just strange Lovecraftian creatures with intelligence we can't comprehend. They are just hanging all around us, but we never notice how weird they truly are until some Tillinghasts start poking around with their science machines.
Well, between The Last of Us on HBO and, you know, Annihilation, the spores and fungus are really having their day.
Yeah, they are.
They're so hot right now.
Clint Page writes, for years I've been expecting Tom Waits, what's he building in there, to come up on this podcast. It's always felt like a Lovecraft story elegantly compressed into 5 minutes of spoken word and sound effects. This was the perfect story for it to finally appear in the conversation.
I believe it's come up several times, actually.
Yeah.
Tom Waits is kind of like the guy in Shadow Over Innsmouth, you know, the drunk fisherman that kind of spills the deal on everything that happened out on that island.
Uh-huh.
If you wanted that to be a band or a musical act, that's what Tom Waits is to me. He's just that guy with a random assortment of junk he's going to make songs with tonight.
Yeah. Steve writes, how does he know it's a scream of pain, not a groan of ecstasy? Mm. He's only lowering the frequency to the top end of the audible, and so is making it sound like a scream to him. He just needs to lower that sound a bit more.
Don't kink shame these plants. All right, Steve. Nils Hendrickson writes, the narrative of mycorrhizal fungi acting like conduits for nutrient transfer between trees and seedlings is everywhere. Sure, it makes a great story, but the evidence is inconclusive at best.
Aww.
Some scientists have been very successful at popularizing their hypotheses, making life difficult for the rest of us. I also work in this field.
Oh.
So if you don't mind being that person, the next time you hear somebody mention mother trees or nursing trees, you can tell them that forests are just as full of wonder without benevolent human qualities. That kind of reasoning is scary to me, as it seems to imply that human qualities are required in order for something to have value.
Ooh.
If you would like more information about this, then I am happy to send it. Thank you for a great show. First of all, I'm happy to hear this because I like my plant life truly alien.
Yes.
So personifying it in this way is just making it uncool to me.
Thank you.
Briar Ripley Page writes, I had to pause the episode to laugh over Chad's true crime bat impression. And I gotta say, when I'm editing the show, a lot of time I'm like, oh, please, just shut up. It could be very uncomfortable listening to oneself. But I got myself with that one, too. I didn't remember doing it. And then I heard the little, and it made me laugh. So I'm with you, Briar. Nick Wassell writes, you know you're listening to a good weird fiction podcast when a story about a family turning into bees isn't strange enough. Right on. Into the Great Atomic Grammatizator. This is where some hot discussion went down.
Aaron Campbell, personal friend of mine, guy I've met on many occasions, great comic book illustrator. Look up his stuff if you haven't seen it. He's been doing some stuff for Hellblazer recently.
Oh, cool.
He's a treasure. And he wrote this. AI imagery or writing will never become as a respected or viable art form for the same reason that AI robots will never replace athletes. People are drawn to art for the same reason they are drawn to sports. The pursuit of human excellence. No one would care if a robot climbs El Capitan without a harness or ropes, but when Alex Hanol did it, it was astounding. No one would care if an algorithm spit out the Sistine Chapel, but we are overwhelmed when we learn a man did this over 500 years ago. We can care less what stories an algorithm has to tell, but the words of H.P. Lovecraft have captivated generations of dreamers. Humans will always strive for human connection. There is no human connection in algorithms, only novelty. And as far as art goes, that is all it will ever be.
Yeah, right on.
What he's talking about, art, I mean, by definition, is something that is created by a person to communicate something. So if a human is not creating, it is therefore not art. So I think the term AI art shouldn't be. He uses it here. It says AI imagery, because that's what it is. It's just imagery created by an artificial intelligence.
Jeremy Impson writes, I agree with all of this, but it misses an important concern. Do enough people actually care about the human spirit, he writes in caps, to pay enough humans a living wage, much less a wage coincident with their contribution to a project? We've already seen the writers and graphic artists being abused by large movie and video game production companies, because said companies have a monopoly over the job market. They dictate the timelines, they dictate the wages, and they dictate the contract terms. And it's been going on far longer in the garment industry. They get away with this because we don't have strong unions, and we, the consumers, don't spend our money according to ethical standards. With artistic AI, the Disneys and the EAs will not hesitate to get around the ethical problems by getting rid of artists almost completely. At that point, there will no longer be any artist professions that one can make a living at, unless we, the consumers, really do demand that the emerging AI economy acknowledge the value taken from pre-existing work. Mm. I honestly think that very soon we will not be able to recognize AI art from human-made. Mm. There will be some of us who will still attach an artificial value from knowing how it was created, and we won't be in the majority, and we will be ripe of being taken advantage of by fraudsters.
Yep, everything is changing, as things often do and always do. And
is this the AI? You just did it.
I did, yeah. Philip Cowan writes, a great month of stories ending with a real chill right in the last line of this tale, which I believe holds the key to Dahl's philosophy of writing. I might be reading too much into this, but Adolf Hitler was a second-rate artist who reaped endless misery, crushing the human spirit with his war machine. Is the dictator the inspiration for Adolf, who is a bad writer with no imagination and is happy to destroy everyone who is creative? Is there a theme here? It is imagination that makes us human. Even if you bludgeon your husband to death or knock off your young tenants, there is a modicum of virtue in you if you can act imaginatively. I love the way Dahl sets a scene or creates characters with just a few lines, but even here, the virtue is in imagination. He leaves it to us, the reader, to conjure it all up in our head.
It's the thing he values the most.
Yeah,
that definitely was a theme that wound through the whole month. Drix writes, I don't think you're reading into it much at all. This is a post-World War II story, so the choice to have the main character named Adolf is certainly a conscious one. Moreover, he is quite literally a spurned artist who goes on to create a machine that, as you noted, has the potential to destroy the world of art as we know it. The direct analog between the two Adolfs is definitely something Dahl wanted the reader to consider while reading. I find that when the story is viewed through this lens, it makes Dahl's philosophy on the whole matter of AI-generated art quite clear. The mass production of literature can only lead to the destruction of the world of art in general, or at least lead to a massive reckoning and shift in worldview. Mm. I'm sure Chris and Chad thought about this kind of stuff too, but the story and current events coupled to create a ton of topics of discussion that it would be hard to contain all in one episode. Boy, you got that right.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you brought this analogy up too, because it's the first thing in the story that caught my eye when I read it, and I went in with a similar perspective to yours.
Louis Davies writes, Dahl really predicts a lot of contemporary commentary on AI. It doesn't need to be good, just good enough that you can sack people. I wonder if the story also feeds into Dahl's hatred of films of his work. The idea of signing your name over to a creating machine that uses your name, feeds your starving children, but which isn't you and you don't control, could be a description of the author's relationship with Hollywood when their works get optioned. He hated Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and he wrote Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, where the protagonist is menaced by a flexible alien sausage monster as an attempt to create something that no one would be able to film, a thing the machine could not replicate. It worked too, but largely because it's not very good and no one wants to film it.
That sucks that he didn't like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, because I love that movie.
Yeah, me too.
Boy, if he hated the Hollywood industry, and I think you're probably correct about this stuff. I mean, his dead entity is just got all those works got optioned for tons of money.
Yep.
So he's
the irony.
He's producing for the machine, just like the writers in his story.
Yeah.
His entity, his personality has basically been licensed.
But when would they say that? He had a TV show.
He did.
In the UK about his stuff. He obviously was up for it. I guess it's the cha-ching got him to go, well, I know I don't like it, but I'll take that paycheck.
I mean, I think that he's probably like most writers who imagine that they, I include myself with this. You want a lot of control over your stuff. So it wasn't the way that he would have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore it wasn't very good. And it's hard to give up that.
Yeah.
It's hard to share being an artist with with another person, much sure. less a machine. Roald Dahl, yeah. though, he also wrote the screenplay for You Only Live Twice.
Really?
I like that Nancy Sinatra song.
That's great.
But the film is not one of my better, it's not one of the better Connery Pond films. Mm-hmm. And like right in the opening of the movie, he's like, why do Chinese women taste different?
God.
I mean, it's like the opening line of
wow.
the movie right before he gets killed in a Murphy bed for some reason. So Roald Dahl, this is the part I said I was going to make fun of him a little bit. I mean, it's a crap Jeez. Screenplay, let's be honest.
Jeremy Gotilla writes, I'm okay with AI and robots as long as the people who own them don't decide 90% of us are unnecessary. The sad thing is they won't have to do anything except take all the jobs and wait for us to starve unless we alter the economic systems that underpin our society.
Mm.
True.
Professor Koshka writes, this story is more about the conversation that it sparks than the text itself. You hit the nail on the head there for one of the things that makes a good science fiction story a good science fiction story. I teach at a community college and chatbots are a huge topic of discussion right now. I agree with Chad that some of the ways we evaluate a student's understanding of course material needs to change, but the existence of chatbots is only a minor factor. The establishment of higher education has lots of issues, mostly due to its roots in power structures that were very much about controlling who had access to knowledge, but I digress. Anyway, term papers are not just about conveying what you know, but also how do you communicate that information. Writing assignments do have their place, even with the advent of advanced chatbots. I'm seeing many of my colleagues spending more class time on independent writing instead of the writing being an out-of-class assignment that gets turned in. In addition to the benefit of the professor being right there to help students when the students need it, you'd be hard-pressed to use a chatbot when the producer is right there with you.
Mm-hmm.
The professor. Yeah, I think that is a good use of class time. Actually, I always found that to be productive.
Jeremy Ibsen writes, I want to thank Chad and Chris for pointing out how AI tools have the potential to enable a new level of personal creativity. As some of my other comments to this episode reveal, I get caught up in the negative aspects of AI and unrestrained capitalism. I certainly hope AI technology is open and accessible. It actually isn't right now, but I expect that to change soon once the understanding of the new approaches becomes better understood by the open source community. There will be a longer journey to get fair and open access to training materials, however. I do also want to say that I didn't expect Chris to be so open to this possibility. In earlier discussions about the definition of art, and Chris tended to feel that art was inherently more than the work rendered by a person. Yeah, I do still feel that way. And like I said at the top of the show, I don't think it should be called AI art. It should be called AI imagery. And one could conceivably generate AI imagery that they use in their art.
Yeah.
So whatever it is. So for example, one of the things I would love AI to do for me, take my existing artwork that I've done, scan it in, and then use that to make my comic book for me. I go in and tweak things. I pick the images. I pick the composition, how I want those things to be. But then use that to tell a story. And that story that I'm telling, the graphic novel, is a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
The elements of it. I think about things like a collage.
Yeah.
You know, you take images, you cut up those images, and you put them together. Those images that you're getting aren't necessarily art. It's what you do with it that makes it art.
Right. I really think that there's a mid-level graphic designer job that this is the thing that threatens the most. It's less than it does the key art people.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I ran a little art department before, and it was really, or if you think about the graphics department for the news or something like that, there are a lot of layout and mm-hmm. quick image generation things. You might have in the past licensed a service that had stock photos or stock art
yep.
in order to fulfill those needs. And that'll get replaced by AI to get some costs down. And that's where the real hit's gonna come yep. in for folks who are sort of Photoshop jockeys.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Cannon writes, oh, I guess I'm a total Luddite when it comes to this stuff. Art can only be produced by a human being or maybe a gorilla or elephant with access to paints. But an AI can only generate product.
Yeah.
Humans can churn out product too, don't get me wrong. There are millions of James Patterson and Star Wars novels to prove that. But when you want art, you need to go to an artist. If you want a print of something in a or a t-shirt design or some consumable Disney crap, you don't need a human being at the tiller. See, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They're repurposing things that have already been generated. You can plug an AI into Rembrandt or Vivaldi and get a facsimile back, but it's not going to be a Rembrandt or Vivaldi. Agreed.
Yeah. And unfortunately for most people, that's enough.
Yeah, or they don't have a choice in the matter. You know, it just comes on the plate
that's
that
true,
they
yeah.
ordered or whatever.
Jason Thompson writes, Peter Watts' Blindsight novel depicts a near future where AI essentially runs humanity, not as evil overlords, but simply because why would you ever not follow an AI suggestion when humans are so much worse at everything? And this leads to a general ennui and despair about the pointlessness of being human. This is only the backdrop of the main plot, which is about the first contact with aliens.
That sounds cool, though.
Sounds really cool.
That's a neat thing to have in the background of a world. Michael Cunliffe writes, okay, AI and the creative function, here we go. In one of my roles, I am the creative lead at a visual arts studio for people experiencing mental health issues and have been doing a lot of work around the specific action of how creativity creates a positive mental state. Mm. It's very common for people to begin their journey by wanting to recreate a specific artwork, genre, or item that they have seen and set this duplication as a criteria for success, which rarely pans out and is based on the concept of art as product. I want to make this thing. Instead, we work hard to engage people in the process of creativity, understanding how time spent making art is valuable regardless of what the final piece may be like. Mm-hmm. I have enjoyed making.
Something I say to my kids a lot. They both draw, they're both illustrators, and sometimes they get down on their stuff. I'm like, it doesn't matter. You know, this is all just part of the, just do it for the sake of doing it. The end result doesn't matter. And eventually you're going to get to some end result that you're going to love. But the only way you're going to get there is by just doing it.
In psychological terms, the comment continues, this is about creating a flow state, placing the individual in a state of mind where the daily struggles are temporarily forgotten while the full attention is placed in the creative process. From this perspective, an AI art generator is likely useless as it produces a product without the engaging process and resulting psychological relief. The machine makes an item, but the value of making the item is lost. The closest comparison I can make is knitting, a pastime that is often referred to as relaxing and enjoyable, but if you just wanted a knitted jumper, it's quicker and cheaper to get one in a shop.
Yeah.
There's a lot more great stuff about all of these topics in our comments section. We can't get to it all.
Yeah, it's huge. Go over there, read it. Lots of food for thought. Thoughtful people writing cool stuff. Check that extra stuff out there.
I thought there might be a little more conflict, but I think all in all, we're all sort of agreeing on this, which helps reduce some anxiety that I had in terms of
how
people see this.
Extra credit, number 7, Cabinets of Curiosities. Graham Eberhardt writes, pushes up glasses. Actually, Chris, I think you'll find that the line in the Beverly Hillbillies theme is black gold, not liquid gold.
Oh, there you go.
He's right.
You screwed it all up, man.
I did.
Invalidated that whole episode. You know, Graham is in a band called Mayhem Lettuce, and I'm going to do a remix of one of their songs soon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so even more music coming up.
Nick Vossel writes, the liquid gold thing from Dreams in the Witch House is one of those it just works things that always just breaks the world for me. He takes a sip and straight away he can wander into another plane of existence and find his dead loved one.
Yeah.
At this stage of history, how is this stuff not available over the counter in a chemist by now? Or at least with a prescription. Maybe it's because he really believes and it wouldn't work for just anyone, but I don't remember it making that point in the film. And how is this not problem solved? His sister is basically fine as a ghost, and he can go and chat with her for a couple of minutes at a time whenever he wants.
I said this exact thing when I was watching it. I was like, this seems like a pretty good situation, actually.
Not the worst thing about the adaptation, of course, but very annoying. I agree, Nick.
Thomas Rawlings writes, agree with our esteemed host's take on the 2 Lovecraft episodes of Cabinet of Curiosities. I'd add the idea in Dreams of the Witch House that a religion can protect you just broke the cosmic horror. Totally agreed.
Yep.
However, I'd note the other 2 episodes, Lot 36 is very good and The Viewing has a real sense of cosmic horror. I'd recommend that.
Lewis Davies writes, I was really struck that Guy Davis, who has worked on the World of Darkness books and Hellboy, BPRD, did the creature design for many of these and is an excellent concept artist, but these weren't very inspiring. I'm at a loss for what went wrong here. And I know Guy Davis's work. I'm a big fan of his stuff. And I'm shocked that he designed those. So I don't know what happened either.
Jeppe Mullick writes, I think Chris is spot on. The autopsy and graveyard rats are the standouts of the show. Meanwhile, the 2 Lovecraft shorts are by far the worst. The rest of the episodes are at least worth a watch. I wanted to include all this stuff so that, you know, because I hate raining on parades, even though I didn't like those episodes, I would love the show to keep going. And and so the autopsy, graveyard rats, those are good ones to see, as well as Lot 36 in The Viewing. Mm-hmm. Let's conclude this episode of feedback. Rob Gilly writes, the version of Pickman's model that Chris did with Greg Johnson is the best adaptation of that story I've ever seen. And it was only a partial adaptation. Del Toro should have hired them to do Pickman. That would have been fun to watch. But then I think Greg Johnson should be hired to do all the things.
I agree.
Well, we hired him all month for these Aikman stories.
Oh, yeah. He's doing a great job, and he is such a talent, and I love that guy to death.
That's all we have for this feedback episode. We're going to have Meeting Mr. Miller by Robert Aikman coming up later this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackin. You've been listening to The Feedback Show exclusively on Patreon.
Strange studies of strange stories.